Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. Today, I'll be reading from the Smithsonian Magazine, and the first article is written by Frank Lintz, titled, The Strange Beauty of the Epic Fail. The new Museums of Inventions that Bombed Boldly celebrates the world's most creative screw-ups. What's not to love about my friend Kayla? A doll designed to be a child's best friend? Using speech recognition software and Google Translate technology, the talking companion can understand and respond to her young owners in real time about her pets, hobbies, and favorite foods. And by accessing the internet, Kayla, who in 2015 won the British Toy and Hobby Association's coveted Innovative Toy of the Year Award, can even answer questions about the world at large. The cardboard housing of the first interactive doll boasts, I know so much about you. Maybe too much. Advocacy groups claim that Kayla's sweet look of innocence masks a sinister side. By talking up Disney movies and characters, they say she acts as a stealth shill for the studio, which pays for the advertising. And Kayla's unsecured Bluetooth connection could allow a hacker to tap her private conversations and steal the personal data she prompts the kids to provide, such as home addresses and names of relatives. Earlier this year, German parents were advised to disable or destroy Kayla over concerns that she can spy on the Muppets who befriend her. The toy is now banned in Germany, where authorities have deemed it an espionage device. The story of my friend Kayla serves as an up-to-date object lesson in the new Museum of Failure, which is dedicated to innovation and design misfires. A lighthearted take on the creative process, the wide-ranging collection debuted this past June in Sweden and will have its first U.S. pop-up this month at an exhibition sponsored by the C Global Entertainment Company in Los Angeles. To be displayed, an item must have been a product that led to an unexpected outcome and, on some level, bombed. Kayla was a commercial success, concedes Samuel West, the museum's founder and curator. The doll, manufactured by U.S.-based Genesis Toys, is still on the market here and abroad. But the backlash made her a promotional disaster. West has rescued scores of monumental duds from the garage sale of history. Each failure is uniquely spectacular, he says, while success is nauseatingly repetitive. Among the objet trouves, many of which were found on eBay, is the Sony Betamax video recorder, a Laserdisc, bottles of Heinz green ketchup, and colorless Crystal Pepsi, coffee-flavored Coca-Cola, and Orbitz, a texturally enhanced beverage whose floating edible balls suggest nothing so much as a lava lamp. Ill-fated mobile gadgets are amply represented. The short-lived Nokia N-Gage, a telephone and games console hybrid. The Amazon Fire Phone, a smoldering shambles with a maddening hard sell button. And the legendary Twitter Peak, a $200 stocking stuffer that, though solely dedicated to Twitter, featured a 20-character home screen, too small to fit a full 140-character tweet. And of course, the wearable computer known as Google Glass, a notoriously faulty attempt to insert the web into a pair of spectacles. Then there's Bic for Her, an embossed ballpoint in pink and lavender that promised a soft, peerless grip for all-day comfort. The so-called lady pen, discontinued in 2016, was immortalized in sardonic reviews on the Amazon website. I bought these for a woman at work as she couldn't figure out how to use a man's pen, one purchaser, presumably a sardonic male, reported. After I helped her open the package, she was super happy. One super happy female wrote, I gave these to all the men in my office, and they all received pay cuts a few weeks later. For sheer shock value, nothing tops the infamous Rejuvenique beauty mask. When strapped to the face for 15-minute intervals, the contraption allegedly tones skin and reduced wrinkles by transmitting mild electric impulses to all 12 of the wearer's facial zones. Powered by a 9-volt battery and endorsed by Dynasty star Linda Evans, Rejuvenique looked like the ice hockey mask worn by the teen stalking psycho in Friday the 13th. The novelties showcased in the museum all tanked for different reasons. Some due to price or poor design, some because management feared the product wouldn't take off, like the Kodak's digital camera patented back in 1978, some due to hubris, Harley Davidson's brand extension Hot Rod, an eau de toilette for men who wanted to smell like a chopper, and some because they didn't live up to the hype, the Segway, a two-wheeled self-balancing scooter. When it appeared in 2001, the Segway was supposed to be revolutionizing public transportation, Wes says. Today, it's used by mall cops and tourists before they go get drunk. He allows that his inclusions and exclusions are subject to debate, which in itself makes the museum interesting. A man with multiple sclerosis emailed West to protest the presence of the Segway. "It is my legs and has reopened everyday life so that I might enjoy social interaction with others, be it shopping, art at a museum, music at a concert, nature at a park, family. It has given me both normalcy and dignity." West acknowledges that failure is contextual. Personal or humanitarian success may coincide with a commercial misfire. A one-time innovation researcher at Sweden's Lund University, the 43-year-old West holds a doctorate in organizational psychology and counsels corporations on how to achieve success by embracing failure. "Failure is something to be celebrated," he says. "It's a natural and essential part of innovation." He invokes a quote attributed to the media executive John Sinclair. "Failure is a bruise, not a tattoo. Failure hurts, and it may not look good," reasons West, "but it will pass." He may as well be describing the Apple Newton message pad, a bulky handheld gizmo from 1993, touted as the first personal digital assistant with handwriting recognition. Though the unreliable Newton went belly up almost immediately, it's now regarded as the great-great-granddad of the iPhone. West notes that in Silicon Valley, failure is often viewed as heroic and instructive. Indeed, Dave McClure, co-founder of the 500 Startups Incubator for Tech Ventures, once said that he seriously considered naming the company Fail Factory. "We're here trying to manufacture fail on a regular basis, and we think that's how you learn." In June, McClure resigned as CEO for engaging in what the organization termed inappropriate interactions with women in the tech community. A self-manufactured fail, if there ever was one. The British entrepreneur Richard Branson, whose empire has included hotels, airlines, and the world's first commercial space line, recently tweeted a line about failing from Samuel Beckett's prose piece, Worstward Ho. "Ever tried, ever failed? No matter, try again, fail better." Ironically, the phrase was intended not as a motivational motto, but as an exhortation to keep failing until you fail completely or die trying. A few lines later, Beckett added, "Fail again, or better worse, fail worse again. Still worse again? Till sick for good? Throw up for good." Silicon Valley venture capitalist Jeff Lewis is equally skeptical of celebrating real failures. Mindful of all the employees who had been laid off or relegated to dead-end assignments due to executive product bungling, Lewis says he'd like to see the pendulum swing back a bit toward fear, toward something one can rebound from, something to be neither embellished nor marginalized, but rather something to be mourned and then moved on from, plainly a tragedy. West isn't quite so gloomy. "The message I want to convey is that it's okay to share your unrefined ideas, your stupid questions, your failures, without then being negatively judged." It's fitting that his museum was launched in Sweden, birthplace to the Vasa, perhaps the most epic technological fail in the 17th century. The hull of the lavishly appointed frigate was 226 feet long, 398 feet wide, and rose to 63 feet high at the stern. Those specifications contained a fatal design flaw. The upper works of the hull were too tall and heavily built for the relatively small amount of hull below the waterline. The ship's five decks were designed to carry a complement of 133 seamen and 300 soldiers, among its 64 cannons and 48 massive bronze 24-pounders, all of which made the vessel dangerously unsteady. Just minutes into the Vasa's maiden voyage, the wind picked up in Stockholm Harbor, and lacking the ballast to counterweight the heavy artillery, the ship heeled until the water rushed in through the open gun ports. Having traveled less than a mile, the world's latest weapon of mass destruction turned turtle and sank. A scale model of the Vasa was on view at the Museum of Failure's first home in the Swedish port city of Helensburg. West, for his part, would direct visitors to a tiny confession booth and ask them to jot down their greatest failures on index cards, which were then posted on a wall. One card read, "I crashed my car driving to the Museum of Failure." West's own biggest flub? When I bought the internet domain name, I accidentally misspelled museum. High overhead and difficulty finding permanent space caused him to close shop in Helensburg in September. Fortunately, the city stepped in and offered the museum a home in its cultural center. The April reopening will include exhibits that highlight failed social and nonprofit innovations. West savors the irony of the exhibition's initial stumble. I should put the Museum of Failure on display at its own museum. And the next article out of the Smithsonian, under the National Treasure section, is written by Jeff McGregor, titled "Robot Love: How a Fussy but Brave Protocol Droid Gives the Star Wars Franchise an Unlikely Dash of Humanity." "Did you hear that? They shut down the main reactors. We'll be destroyed for sure. This is madness." The first line spoken in the first Star Wars movie 40 years ago was delivered by a fussy android with a plummy pan British accent. Since then, C-3PO, returning to the screen in The Last Jedi, has been bought, sold, blasted, dismantled, dismembered, imprisoned, exploded, rebuilt, rebooted, and made an Ewok god. He is the expressionless and instantly recognizable gold-plated face of the franchise. Head tipped just so, shuffling like a geisha, he arrived on screen as a quantum upgrade to Robbie the Robot by way of P.G. Woodhouse. He has always and only ever been played in the movies by the actor Anthony Daniels. The first thing you notice about C-3PO, a costume from 1983's Return of the Jedi resides in the Smithsonian National Museum of American History, is the unblinking lantern eyes set below sculpted brows, then the hyphen of the mouth beneath the brushstroke of a nose. "Like something out of Kabuki," Daniel says. "It's a wonderful blank, beautiful mask that you can put or place an emotion on." He plays it that way, indicating emotions by posture alone, the angle of the chin, the poise of the fingertips. Programmed to serve, C-3PO is a protocol droid, fluent in 7 million languages, a courtier, even diplomatic, and acutely aware of himself in the political and practical moment. Often frightened to find comic relief, he is just as often a reluctant hero. "He absolutely isn't cowardly," Daniels will tell you politely. "He is self-preservational. He knows what danger is about, and why would you not run from danger? Why would you not try and prevent people from running into danger?" In 1976, Daniels was appearing in a London stage production of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and was determined not to take a job on a trivial sci-fi film. Then he saw Ralph McQuarrie's concept sketch for C-3PO. He saw something in that face. The first three Star Wars films, 1977, 1980, and 1983, all narrative drive and swashbuckle, still hold up. Fast-paced and funny, they repackaged an archetype quest for revenge and reconciliation as an outer space western. Good versus evil, dark against light. Simple R2-D2 and C-3PO are the mismatched comic relief, an intergalactic odd couple as Greek chorus. 3PO, the neat-nick Felix to RT's solemnly Oscar, reminding the audience what's at stake and how the principal really feels. You need a balance of elements in all these films. It's a fairy story. It's a romp. So there's serious bits, the dangerous bits, whatever, and then occasionally the refreshment of a character who doesn't really fit into the environment, Daniel says. That was another brilliance of George Lucas, that you can come back to the protocol and etiquette thing. These are the last skills ever to be required in a horrible desert surrounded by ghastly people. Still, C-3PO translated all, not only into English, but into a series of unheroic, recognizable human responses. Worry, fear, joy, sadness. On screen, he is us. We seem to be made to suffer. It's our lot in life, the droid says in that first long-ago movie. What could be more human? A low-budget, low-expectation success story, that original trilogy is still as canonical to its core fans as anything. When not busy with the sacred franchise, Daniels is a visiting scholar at Carnegie Mellon University's Entertainment Technology Center, talking futurism and tech and hardware and software with students. 40 years ago, robots were a thrilling part of an uncomplicated science fiction future. Now they're part of a darker revolution on screen and off, in which machines take over entire sectors of the world economy, leaving humans to languish. Thus does the world's most famous android and the man who plays him meet in the moment of our suddenly complicated relationship with automation. When the robot comes for your job, will that beautiful face look so benign? Fully human Harrison Ford earns his living these days reprising his roles as Han Solo, or Indiana Jones, or Rick Deckard. He is busy acting his age. Like Ford, Anthony Daniels has seen the years advance as he has played one of the most recognizable characters on the planet. But you wouldn't know it. The mask is ageless. Still slender enough to fit the suit at 71, still in possession of that wonderful voice. Have I ever thought of retiring? He says. Yes, I have thought about it. Am I going to? No. One day, not too far, far away, even this robot will be automated out of a job, and C-3PO will be rendered by a computer. Still, he can be played only one way, the way Anthony Daniels plays him. And moving on with the next article written by Jasmine Ward, titled The Visionary, Ava DuVernay. Ava DuVernay makes art that looks squarely at society and takes it to task. Mass incarceration is important to me. The fracturing of the black family structure is important to me. The trauma of history on the black family unit is really important to me, she says. DuVernay has directed shorts, documentaries, television series, and feature films. With her second feature, Middle of Nowhere, 2012, she became the first African-American woman to win Best Director Award at the Sundance Film Festival. She makes films because she wants to foster beauty in the world, because she wants to stir strong emotion in her viewers. But her art is also a weapon, which she wields carefully and lovingly because she believes in fighting for justice and fighting for good. This is why she can bring characters Nova, Charlie, and Ralph Angel Bordelon, Queen Sugar, to life. Make them so real and multidimensional that viewers care for them even as they rail against the world intent on cowing them. The series, based on the novel by Natalie Brazil and produced by Oprah Winfrey, examines the forces that unite and divide three siblings after their father dies, bequeathing them an 800-acre sugar farm in contemporary Louisiana. In the end, DuVernay is taking the things important to her and crafting stories of fallible people we love. Important to her, such as representations of family, representations of black womanhood, and representations of good over evil. Born in 1972, she grew up in Compton, south of downtown Los Angeles, and she graduated from UCLA with a degree in English and African American Studies. She made her directorial debut in 2008 with the hip-hop documentary This Is the Life. When DuVernay was a child, her aunt Denise fostered a love of art in her, but also showed her that art and activism could be combined. Her aunt was a registered nurse who worked night shifts so she could pursue her passion during the day, which was art and literature and the theater. She was a patroness. She worked to live, but what she loved in life was the arts. She was fed by it, says Duvernay. That was a huge influence on me. And her mother was socially conscious, and both women taught her that you could say something through the arts. Duvernay is fearless despite working in an industry that hasn't seen many black women who direct, write, or maintain a career longevity. She began as a publicist, and she was good at it. Over the years, she developed a voice and vision that flowered into reality as she made more films and documentaries and television that effortlessly combined art and activism across forms. When I asked her about her career, she says, "I try to be a shapeshifter and do a lot of things. A, because I can. B, because the traditional walls collapse so there's more flexibility. And C, because you can't hit a moving target." Her next film is A Wrinkle in Time, based on the science fiction novel by Madeline Ellingall. Scheduled for release in March, it is the first live-action feature film with a budget of $100 million or more to be directed by a woman of color. Her social consciousness and her appreciation of good art not only inform her work, but they inform how she works as well. Planning for Queen Sugar, which has run for 2 seasons on the OWN network and has been approved for a third, she made a list of possible directors and then noticed that they were all women. "I thought, we should commit to this. At a time in the industry where there's a lack of opportunity for women, we could really use our platform here to say something important about correcting a wrong." A total of 17 women directed the 29 episodes of the first 2 seasons. Duvernay's first directing job in scripted non-documentary TV came in 2013 on the series Scandal. After other offers followed, she has said she realized what one episode of television can do for someone who hadn't had it before. Duvernay's perspective adds a revelatory dimension to the representation of black people in this country. We have decades of art, music, literature, and film that bears testament to a black America's survival and drive to thrive in the United States. Much of it is powerful and moving. Often it reconfirms our fire, our fight. Frequently, it reconfirms our agency and centers our stories. "All black art is political," Duvernay told me. "I think our very presence is political. Anyone that is able to establish a voice and a consistent presence and put their voice forth is doing something radical and political with their very presence." But her work bears something more. It shows us an aspect of ourselves, of black people, that we rarely see on film. It allows us vulnerability. In Queen Sugar, the characters, women and men, children alike, show emotion when they are sad or conflicted or in pain. They cry and they sob and weep because they feel unappreciated or betrayed or angry or remorseful. They feel safe enough with one another, safe enough in the world to bear their hearts with those they love. The experience of watching authentic vulnerability on the screen helps us to understand that we don't have to be invulnerable, ever strong, ever inviolable, ever emotionless, even though this world seems to demand this of us. Instead, if we find ourselves in places of safety with people who engender that safety, we can let ourselves feel. Duvernay knows her show has this effect. "Some people say he," as in Ralph Angel, "cries too much," she says laughing. "But it's very feminine, very caring show." When I fell in love with Queen Sugar in the first episode, I realized how starved I'd been for emotionality in someone who looked like me. Duvernay makes films that defy convention. Her films often seek to invert the tradition of dehumanization of black people and the black body in the media. In the larger culture, where the standard depiction of black people involves the exploitation of suffering, she wields the power of the image to jar her viewer into empathizing with suffering. She does this to devastating effect in 13th, her documentary on racial injustices in the criminal justice system. The title refers to the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which abolished slavery, except as a punishment for crime. The film, a Netflix original, was nominated for an Academy Award and won 4 Emmy Awards and a Peabody Award. The film shows one clip after another of black men and women who have been killed by police violence. So the audience is witness to one black person dying, and then another, and then another. Even as a girlfriend sits in the passenger seat, documenting and crying as a child whimpers in the back seat in shock. The effect is immediate. By bracketing these images with testimony from academics, respected purveyors of truth, as they explain the horrors of police violence, the dehumanization of black people that enables multiple systems to fail us again and again, the cost of that dehumanization becomes clear. The viewer weeps at the torrent of human tragedy on the screen. There is no denial of police brutality, no room for post-it. But all lives matter. 13th helped prompt the art collector and philanthropist Agnes Gund to sell a Roy Lichtenstein painting and use $100 million of the proceeds to start the Art for Justice Fund, which will promote changes in the criminal justice system. DuVernay also encourages the viewer to appreciate the beauty of the black body and the vitality of black life through filming the black body with love. Queen Sugar opens with close-ups of a woman's arms and legs and hair, a woman we will later know as Nova. But the way the camera closely tracks her seems to act more like a caress. This is beauty, we understand. The skin that shines, this hair that winds in a tangled fall. It's true, DuVernay loves her characters. When asked about the subjects of her work, she says, "I'm not a director for hire. I choose what I do. Anything I'm embracing is something that I'm involved in from the ground up. I do love everything that I'm doing, and I love the stories that I'm telling." We viewers understand this when we see Nova lovingly lit, when we see Charlie framed by the landscape she's fighting so hard to understand, when we see Ralph Angel's face break when he's standing in the fields he's fighting so hard to hold on to. We see this refrain again in the credits of 13th, when photographs flash across the screen of black people, young and old, women and men and children, smiling, hugging, riding horses, and cooking. We are used to regarding ourselves in a film as one-dimensional, one thing. That's not true. We know we can be many things at once, DuVernay says. These are layers of dimension, of being, in one life, in one body. The goal is to show the different dimensions of us. At the close of 13th, the photographs, many of her family and friends, are a celebration of how complicated humanity can be, a fountain of black joy in the face of oppression. This is Ava DuVernay's vision. This is her voice. She says, "Here are people who love. Here are people who feel joy and tenderness and kindness. And in the end, here are people who are." That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the December issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. I'm Laura Bogart. So long, until next time.